their work in the 90s fitted in very much with you could call it a pre-millennial sense of fracturing of kind of postmodernism, almost accelerating into infinity. And then you get the beginning of the 21st century, 9/11, and questions about what are these core values that we're going to be fighting about? What are these kind of core exchanges we're going to be having? And a lot of the, I suppose, questions about what function does theatre have at the moment, it seems to be that there's a lot of political writing around again. And maybe that makes Force Entertainment's work possibly a little, potentially could seem a bit old-fashioned. Do you think that they've, when you say that they're writing about, that they're reflecting the times that we live in, do you not think that they're a step apart from it as well? I mean, there is...
No, I would say that the opposite. In a times, I mean, again, one is always speaking, affected by the immediacies of what's occurring around oneself. So at a time where we live in a period where there seems to be a conflict of certainties, and we've just had that in this week in the election to a certain extent, where a group of people who are so sure about the way the world works can dictate to a certain extent on a global level how we should all behave, both morally, ethically and politically in terms of organisation of societies, that the fragile, the transitory, the questioning of what it is to actually do something is vital. And theatre, for me, is always dealt with this, and this is why, because it's about the attempt to enact something in a particular context, and that for me that goes with musicals or with the highly political plays of Edward Bond or David Hare. To a certain extent, it's how do you behave appropriately in the culture in which we live is the key question of the theatre. This probably goes back to when it first occurred as rituals in early societies. So I think Force Entertainment's work has always been deeply political, not in the sense that it has specific sets of answers, perhaps like Edward Bond's theatre tried to elucidate for us, but it still poses the same question: how to behave, what to do, how do we somehow react to the times in which we live, and what do we do next? If you go back to a piece like Emmanuel Enchanted, I hope I've got the right piece now, even though it's in the 1990s, and you can echo it in or frame it in those terms that you just put in postmodern fragmentary, my memory of that piece is how influenced it was by the fall or the change in societies that was going on in Eastern Europe, where we were watching from our kind of secure Thatcherite position, our world in the UK, to these societies that were undergoing profound change, political uncertainties, where television studios were being kind of overtaken by the public, and the televisions were on all the time, and people were just speaking in languages that I could barely understand. Bombs were falling. It seemed that something very intrinsic was going on, and their work reflected that uncertainty and made me question my relationship to it in a very particular way, and my own sense of security in this country and what that meant to me. And I think their work touches on that in a very different way than the more obvious political theatre that goes on in this country. You could argue in some ways it's perhaps their work is more politically profound, and that would be quite an argument to make, but if pushed I would say that was true for me, at least anyway.
I think that there is another element to your question which I think is pertinent, that there's, one wouldn't expect or demand of Forced Entertainment or anybody else to say anything very specific, but why shouldn't people, on the other hand, and hence the rise of verbatim theatre, and that's very interesting, and there is now space for a very overt political theatre. But it also seems to me that there's a shift in the aesthetics or in the shaping of the thing that's not necessarily said, if that makes sense. I mean, if you are going to have very open texts, and I think of people like Lepage or perhaps Paul Auster in writing in print, or perhaps even Tim Burton as a filmmaker, where there's, in a sense, the exercise is to synthesize what you've been splitting up and being ironic about and being very multi-layered or very fragmentary about. And that's not happening in Forced Entertainment's work. And I think it's that makes them still postmodern, whereas, there's a lot of work now, I think, that is whatever it is, it's post-postmodern because it's attempting to synthesize and perhaps make some coherence, even if it's in its feeling, as to what it's dealing with.
But isn't the work of Force Entertainment, I mean, I agree with what you're saying, Andy, but isn't what's so interesting about Force Entertainment is they, that to a certain extent, they're provoking that synthesis in my own reaction to the piece, and that's crucial to the work. They open a kind of way of being in the performance that then I'm forced in relationship to it to synthesize that material in relation to my own experience, not just in terms of the piece but my remembering of the piece, which I don't get in other types of performance. Well, actually, in one sense I always do get, because no matter how much people think they're synthesizing, they're never synthesizing everything, and it's those things they don't that are always the most interesting. And that's what, coming back to Chekhov, that strikes me as was one of the wonderful things that Chekhov realized, that these people in this sort of strange world, in an attempt to make sense of themselves, never really made sense of it. And the audience laughs at that and engages in that because they relate it to their own lives.
Right. I think that's dead right, but there are degrees of nuance and certainty, if you like, and that the kind of symphonic organization of all of those social references and types and concrete instances of behavior in Chekhov gives you a lot to grasp onto. In Forced Entertainment, I mean, in last night's show, there's a cheerleader who's egging on a pair of fighting clowns. The references are...
They're still extraordinarily saturated with meaning. You know, the cheerleader, again, coming back to this week, you know, it just felt so appropriate. This person is kind of bland, but again, she has the final say. She rips that apart at the end in an extraordinary way by making this demand for endings and things, you know, whereas a cheerleader normally is a kind of on-the-side participant trying to egg the main action going on. She usurps that. There seems to be a very, very... The clown, sort of the tragic figure, is, again, to articulate the narrative of the beginning and the end of the world. Even though they're disconnected, I know what you're saying, in a Chekhovian sense, but in their own right, at any one moment in the piece, they seem to be absolutely laden with significance, almost too laden with significance. You know, the technicians, the most insignificant people in some ways in a theatre performance, because they never appear normally, you don't see them. And I know they're ridiculed slightly, but they kind of boss the piece in a way, you know.
The two guys?
Yeah, in an extraordinary
way. And microphones running the sound.
Absolutely, and that wonderful bit at the end where he suddenly becomes philosophical, you know.
Yes, that conversation between the sound engineer and the clown.
Yeah, it's a wonderful moment.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't disagree. But
and aren't they sort of conversations? They are like, I mean, I know they're very highly refined and highly ironic in some ways, but aren't those conversations as resonant in the framing of our contemporary lives as two of Chekhov's figures talking late at night about the future of the world, you know?
Yes, I'd agree with that, of course, and I respond to that, and I enjoy that in the piece, and that particular conversation was very finely done. And I think what you implied earlier as well is that that kind of work and that kind of organisation of the rhythm and the space can't but come out of a very deep and in some ways a deeply loving rehearsal process.
Yeah.
But if the question is, what is theatre doing, what should it... I mean, I wouldn't really want to address what it should be doing, but what is it doing and how is it working and who's it working for, what are its effects? It seems to me that the work operates on quite a conceptual level, which is why it plays well in the universities, you know, is perhaps why it hasn't made as much of an impact on the mainstream as perhaps it should have done, although that says something about, I think, a British theatre culture as well. But
I think
it does operate on a very conceptual level, and to the point at which you can read about the shows and see what they're doing without necessarily going to them.
That's a bit unfair.
I think that's totally... Well, I think it is totally unfair, particularly about Bloody
but
Red.
But they beg descriptions, don't they? I mean, there are lists of descriptions, and it's as if you can't say anything more except there's a figure with cardboard wings being an angel. Mm-hmm. Okay, we get it.
But, this is maybe an interesting question for Lynn to respond to, because it's not true, I think this is a question Dominic had on your list, Dominic, that it's not true in the rest of Europe that they don't hit the mainstream of a certain mainstream culture anyway. No, they perform in the Pompidou Centre in Paris, which is kind of, in a way, their equivalent of the National. They perform in the major playhouses of Berlin. They're not performing in some sort of avant-garde garage in the side of the town. Yet in Britain, they haven't actually managed, for all sorts of reasons, to affect mainstream theatre. But I don't think, or I'd like to propose, that's not a result of their work. I think that's much more about a culture of theatre tradition in Britain, and perhaps also, not that I'm blaming you, Lynn, at all, but a culture of criticism that hasn't really got to grips, not only with forced entertainment, because you see it, for example, when the Worcester Group come, that if you actually compared the main reviews, and the reviews in the main papers of the Worcester Group, and you compared it with the main reviews of the Worcester Group in the New York papers, there were two completely different modes of complex criticism going on. The New York papers had a way into the work and a way of understanding the tradition of the work in which the English or British critics just didn't come near comprehending in the main. I don't know whether you reviewed that show, I don't remember that you did. But there strikes me there is there's a kind of failure to contextualise certain work in this country. And you see it when, not only in terms of force and tame, but you see it also when visiting companies come from abroad and are always slightly perturbed about the way the British critics react, and the total absence of forced entertainment in television criticism, for example. They never appear on Late Show Review or anything like that. You know, they're not even on the cultural landscape of the mainstream, so it's not surprising in a way.
I don't think that's something that solely the critics should be held to account for, though. I think it's part of a deeper question about our cultural values and how we watch this sort of work, and I think it would be true. I mean, I was thinking, what are forced entertainment European, or are they sort of transatlantic, or are they very definitively English? And I think they are definitively English, but on the other hand, I can see a lot of connections with various sorts of European companies, and perhaps through quite a long inheritance as well. And if that's the case, it's also perhaps because there is more respect for or interest in more high concept work on the continent and a more intellectual engagement with theatre, if I might say so.
Or not a worry about the division between being popular and high concept, that actually the two have always, you know, going back quite a long time. You see it in European opera, for example, experimenters and other forms are allowed access to operatic tradition. So you get filmmakers like the Key Brothers doing opera in major European contexts, which I think in Britain there's been, I know it's changed in the last sort of 5 or 6 years perhaps, but there's a resistance to that. Opera and high art exist in separation to popular culture. You see it in the British attitude towards Shakespeare. Can't really be experimented with. You know, if you start to do anything to the text, it becomes almost like an irreligious, sacrilegious act, you know. Mm. Whereas the Italians, do they care about Shakespeare's text? Raphael, you know?
No, and it absolutely takes, in fact, directors from abroad to come here and do Shakespeare and muck about with the text and come up with something interesting.
Yeah. But I think we have to probably distinguish between a potential failure of subsidised support. I mean, you know, the question is begged, I think, maybe in your piece recently, but Lynn, why aren't they at the National? Mm. And you could argue that
quite simply because the people who run the National wouldn't go and see the work in the first place.
Is it that there is a kind of institutionalised resistance within the theatre culture to that kind of work? Much more, and that's much more important than whatever critical reaction you might have to it, because after all, there are critics who fly the flag for forced entertainment, and that is the distinction that is the comparable situation to those sort of European subsidised festivals, subsidised theatre houses, where they receive a more benevolent response. I mean, as for them being populist, I can't see that. I mean, maybe you can persuade me otherwise, but I can't see that the kind of audiences that they're going to get in the UK. The potential audience is going to get in the UK can be substantially different to the kinds of people who are going to go in Germany or France or wherever they are. I don't think British theatre goers are any less enlightened. The ones that want to see this kind of work are less enlightened than the ones.
I think Andy was making an interesting point, though, and I think it's true in a sense that because forced entertainment are so part of the curriculum at university level now, and possibly at school level in terms of being on the A level syllabus, you create a particular type of audience and a set of expectations. Andy's absolutely right. You create a framework which always is placed over that work, which isn't always appropriate, I think. So it's interesting, and to break out of that for them, they need to hit a more mainstream audience. But whether they'll be allowed to by the theatre culture, I'm not so sure. I think it's a travesty that
I guess the question is whether it's the theatre hierarchy that denies this company that audience, or whether it's the work that makes the audience resistant to the experience, as it were.
Yes, but can you honestly tell me that a show like Bloody Mess isn't kind of so incredibly accessible?
No, I think it's exciting.
Yes, it's exciting, it's funny, it's kind of moving, and you know, you could not possibly, you could take a small child to see that show and they kind of would respond to it. It's not difficult work, and yet actually, you see, I think that in some ways that I think academics and, you know, sometimes do a disservice, because you talk about it in such a way that makes it sound as though it's...
Oh, I talk about everything like this. Like, if I was talking about a children's television program, I'd probably use the same analysis.
But I also think that what happens with critics, you know, is that they perceive somehow that the work is difficult, and basically they don't develop a vocabulary in order to talk about it. I mean, you know, and it is about our culture, isn't it? Because if you look at the whole indoor fireworks season and the companies that were being curated by Forced Entertainment, you would not know if you picked up a broadsheet paper last week and this that was going on. But you do know that the Producers is going on in the West End, and you know that the History Boys is going on at the National and things. And it is about, you know, probably of course it's about economics, isn't it?
I mean, I think Lynn's absolutely right. What I'm saying is, I'm not saying there isn't the interest culturally in performance. I mean, look at the Lyft inquiries, which I know you spoke at and I spoke at, you know, which went on all the way through London in the summer. You know, lots of people went, there were lots of extraordinary interventions in that, and again, it didn't really, for something that was so extraordinary, didn't ever hit the mainstream culture. And for those of us not living in London, which there are many in this country, and that's often forgotten, you wouldn't even known it was on. And I find that rather tragic, really.
But I think given that, the work does need contextualising it. I mean, I think to come back to your question, should it be at the National? Yes, why shouldn't it? But they shouldn't, by the same token, be just hung out to dry. Because you could imagine a National Theatre audience coming to see Forced Entertainment in the Cottesloe or the Lipton or wherever it was, and, you know, half of them potentially demanding their money back. Well, I don't want to travesty the audience, but there must be a context for it. There needs to be a process of either explanation or themed programming or whatever. I mean, I think we're seeing something similar with Shunt, very interesting company, doing quite ostensibly either difficult or certainly unconventional work, and, you know, being reviewed to the effect that the work is either impenetrable and or trivial, and you might as well not see it,
or that the text, basically, that the text gets reviewed to a large extent.
Well, and thereby, you know, therein lies the abiding problem with our theatre culture, for my money.
No, I mean, I think, you know, the Forced Entertainment and the Shunt, you know, kind of illusion, I mean, is so true, because actually, you know, what is the point of putting these things on at the National Theatre if they're not supported in the right sort of way? And, you know, the truth is, with something like Shunt, you know, it would have been reviewed many months into its run, not have a kind of, you know, the shows that were going on down at Bethnal Green, not having a kind of press night in the way that they did.
No, that's, in a way, it's sort of unfair.
Yeah.
But by the same token, Shunt is working with the National Theatre. That's good. But if Shunt is, Forced Entertainment certainly should be, because they are part of our National Theatre now.
I mean, I sort of wonder whether they are a unique, whether, you know, because you're talking about them probably quite rightly in a way as sort of a symptomatic of sort of wider problem or wider sort of schism in a way in the theatre culture. But they are a kind of unique case in some ways, aren't they? Because they are. There's such an implicit argument against the kind of theatre that most people go to see in their work. It is unforgiving of that. I mean, it's a line from Showtime that kind of often pops into my head, actually, where you get a kind of monologue, really, where a character tells the audience what it is that they think they were expecting to get. I've just got a little bit of it. There should be some kind of moral. There should be some kind of purpose, because if there isn't a moral, it's just a lot of bloody shouting and showing off. The audience doesn't pay good money to see a lot of shouting and showing off. It goes on in a provocative vein. It does seem that it's very hard to accommodate a company like that within within any other sort of institution or umbrella organisation where different kinds of theatre work are going on that may command different levels of tolerance from their audience, don't you think? I mean,
if you were brave enough, you know, why not?
But there's a kind of, it's interesting that you quote that, but what you've missed out is who said it and what they were doing at the time, and the person who says that is lying on the stage with a tin of spaghetti poured over his stomach. So he's dying, and it's almost like a dying speech about a dying culture, and there's a provocation in the speech, not so much that this is what we want, but the person says, is this all you want? And I think that's quite an interesting question. But I mean, what's so interesting about Force Entertainment on another level is that they survive so long. There aren't any other companies in their situation previously that have survived 20 years. And survival is, you know, in a funded sector is an appropriate word, because it's difficult. It's very difficult to last that long. I mean, I know they have revenue funding from the Arts Council, but that's relatively recent. So those performers have, you know, done their work on minimum wages, only partly funded in the year, probably having to do lots of other types of jobs to keep going. And there aren't any other companies in this country that have that length of time as part of their legacy. Which isn't to say there aren't individual practitioners that have continued to make work, because there are, going right the way back to Lumiere and Son and Hesitate and Demonstrate and so forth. But as a company to last that long is unique. And in a way, I think that's why, not just their longevity, if you like, it's why they need to have a bit more of a cultural platform from which they can be, you know, enjoy.
Do you think that it's possible to look at their work and their contribution to performance art and see the influence that they've... I mean, you talked about some other bad student productions that you've come across. I mean, do you think they are a sort of... Because they're such a law unto themselves and so imbued with their own particular tone that they... It's very hard to replicate what they do. It's very hard to carry forward what they do. And if they stopped tomorrow, it would actually be very difficult for people to kind of carry on their work. They have to carry on, you know, they themselves must carry it forward. Do you sense that there was a ripple effect at all?
Well, I think there could be. I think there's a lot of influence in, I mean, certainly the university drama departments and perhaps other performance-based institutions which are looking at this sort of work. And you don't know when that's going to come out, and it will have its impact, you know, perhaps at any point over the next 10 or 15 years, albeit that the company's been going for 20 years. So I think there could well be an influence in that sense, but I think in some ways it's easier to trace an inheritance. I don't know if that's part of what you're asking, but I would certainly locate them in some sense in a frame along with the work of Grotowski. I'm thinking of actors sort of earnestly immersing in acts of work, you know, and that being interesting or engaging somehow. So that seems a reference. I was struck yesterday, possibly for the first time, with perhaps a connection with Christoph Martaler's work. Lift brought over a show, I think a couple of shows by Martaler, but one called Merks, which was just a fantastic piece of an ensemble of actors, actually, that in a show whose rhythms and textures were very playful, very punctuated, in something not dissimilar to the rhythms of Bloody Mess, I think. There's a Russian clown company called Derivo, and I think an offshoot called Litsidae, who do quite dark pieces where you don't necessarily have end points to the gags. The opening clown routine reminded me of them. So there is, I mean, I know they've been compared often to the Worcester Group, but it seems to me that there's a European inheritance as well, and that they certainly fit within that.
It was a really interesting collection of names. I mean, Lynn Gardner, did you... When I watched Bloody Mess, I was struck by... There is something rock and roll about this, and they are playing with the fact that they're a bit old to be doing it, or they're a bit old to be locking around in the way that they are. Do you think there's a kind of point at which, from this particular kind of work, this very experimental kind of work, that this company needs to either bring in a different crowd of performers and sort of take more of a backseat, or cease altogether? I don't know whether you felt that it has its own duration, really, a company like this, or whether it doesn't.
I suppose in some ways that's possibly true, that there's kind of no reason why any theatre company actually has to go on forever, and that longevity in itself, you know, isn't necessarily a good thing. Having said that, I think what we're talking about here is a kind of very wide body of work. I think that what we're talking about is, you know, how far that Tim Etchell's, in a sense, is forced entertainment, in the same way that one might talk about, you know, how much is Simon McBurney complicité, and I think, you know, there are kind of parallels between those two there. And I also think that is that we've been talking today really about only kind of one very small, well, not small, but, you know, one aspect of the company's work. And I think one of the things that's been kind of interesting to them is the way that they have kind of responded to new technologies and use new technologies. And one only has to go on the net and see the kind of presence that Forced Entertainment has on the net, or indeed, in fact, that one can make contact on the net with thousands of people around the world who want to talk to you about Forced Entertainment. And I think that, you know, they're in their 40s now, but I think they're kind of growing up and moving into other areas. It would be sad to think that they'd be doing bloody mess in some ways in 20 years' time, but I don't think they will.
There's so much in the landscape, I suppose, in one sense. Even if you're not influenced by them, you can't. They influence you by kind of, you know, default, really, because they're so dominant in a kind of experimental scene. But at the same time, what's interesting for me is that I've seen, or I've felt the presence of others in their work. So, you know, I remember certain pieces that I felt were, you know, influenced by, say, companies like Desperate Optimists, who had their own kind of way of negotiating material. A company's work I thought was absolutely brilliant in the 90s. And again, I think, as Andy says, there's a lot of European work that they've definitely, you know, borrowed material from in one form or another. But I keep coming back to the major influence of their work, which for me is why it's always slightly resonant, is British culture. You know, whether it be Frankie Howard, Tommy Cooper, vaudeville, music hall, it's in there. It strikes me that, and it's a bit like the piece, really, going back to the Hawkwind, it's their youth. That rock and roll, country and western, you know, type of music is the kind of music, I'm the same age as them, that we grew up with. And at the same time, we grew up with the fag ends of music hall, the good old days of those kind of British comics, Two Ronnies. And now I know they're being fated now and replayed, interestingly, by other comics like the people who make Little Britain. But it strikes me that Andy's absolutely right. There's a core British sensibility in this work, and if that keeps being replayed in a way that's resonant for them, then I think I'll always be interested in it.
It was
just another thing. It seems to me actually that you're kind of, that we haven't kind of really even touched upon is the sheer about this thing about playfulness.
Absolutely,
in their
work. It is fun.
It is absolutely, you know, it is like watching kids raiding the dressing up box and kind of smearing on the lipstick and kind of getting it wrong. And there is something kind of immensely engaging about watching that. And also I think that it's true, you know, if you want to put them again, try and put them into some context of the mainstream, is that I think that, you know, if you could, I could have to identify one thing about, you know, some of the great theatre companies like Complicité, like maybe Knee High, people like that, it is that they have this element of playfulness in this work.
Ellen's absolutely right. I went to see I was involved in it as an academic again, God help me. At a conference in Norway, which Forced Entertainment were playing Showtime, and there was the Right Sides were doing a performance at the same time, which I can't remember the title of. It was a piece where they make a play about the First World War. They try and be serious about trying to make a play in their front room about the First World War, and it's a beautiful clowning show, a typical Right Sides performance. And I thought it was so interesting seeing Showtime alongside the Right Sides, was I could see a connection, an absolute connection, totally different theatrical traditions, about clowning, about fun, about relationship to pantomime, to those sort of pantomime is uniquely British. Americans don't understand what pantomime is. They don't know what it is. They don't have it. That Force and Tame, in a very knowing way, are replaying in their own sort of context these theatrical traditions, and I don't think just for its own sake.
I think you've never quite put your finger on it, and that's part of what, for me, is the Englishness of this work, because it's differently passionate, sure, if you like, because if there's a clown, the clown is both funny and not funny. Figure of ridicule, figure of love. The rock music in the show is deeply adored and at the same time ludicrous and to be laughed at, you know? So you never know where you are on,
sure,
this knife edge of irony.
And yeah,
the company, part of the company's material, I mean, on the front of the webpage and in the programme as well, states that one of the interests is in confession, in being confessional. Mm. By the same token, every act of confession, you know, whenever in the trademark moment somebody steps to the front and talks to us, you know that whilst they're confessing, you must at the same time never believe it. It may or may not be true, whatever that is. And it seems to me that gives the work a sort of, not a hesitancy, but a reticence. You know, these people aren't confessing in a Polish way or an American way. They're confessing in an English way. And they're finding their play in an English way.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Very true.
As Lynn has said, we've hardly touched on Falls and Tame. It's been a little bit more than 2 minutes per year, but not much really. Thank you all. Thank you, Lynn Gardner, Andrew Quick, and Andy Lavender.
Thank you.
Thank you.